and welcome. You're listening to episode 64 of Good Copy, Bad Copy, the B2B copywriting podcast. My name's David Maguire. I'm creative director at Radix Communications. And opposite me, as ever, is our founder and lead copywriter, Fiona Campbell-Howes.
As ever. Hello.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good, thank you. How are you?
I'm all right, thank you very much. Yeah, it's a nice summer.
Yes, it is. It's slightly less warm than it has been, which is nice.
Yeah, it's just in between now, yes. At that good level. Right, well, later this episode, we will ask whether B2B's obsession with data is a help or a hindrance to copywriters, and Fiona will unveil her own nomination for our B2B Content Hall of Fame. And if you have any questions or comments about anything you hear, do get in touch. You can send us an email or a voice memo to podcast@radix-communications.com or tweet us at radixcom. That's RADIXCOM. But first, search engine optimization is something we copywriters need to keep in mind all the time, assuming our clients want their content to get found and read. So I spoke to Tom Telford of Three White Hats to get his view on how writers and SEO specialists can work together to get the best result. So as B2B copywriters, one of the things we are always asked when we are talking about web copy is, what is our approach to SEO? And we generally go, we're just writers, mate. We know, you know, a little bit about search engines, but really, you want to be talking to someone that knows a whole lot more about that stuff because it's really specialized. And thankfully, I have one of those people sitting opposite me right now, Tom Telford from Three White Hats.
Hi, guys.
Who we have roped in so that we can ask him some questions about the dark and arcane arts
of the world
of Google. Yeah. Hi, Tom. So welcome.
Thank you.
So, I mean, I guess how much really, from your point of view, should writers know about SEO, and how much should we just leave it alone and leave it to you guys?
I think actually a huge amount, and writers will have one of the biggest impacts in many ways once a site is optimized. So there's two worlds in SEO. We've got content and how, you know, Google needs to see words to work out what you do to then make the assumption for its website. That's content. There's also a way of how do you make the website so that it is in a nice state for Google in the first place. That is really quite technical SEO. And that I think, so quite a lot. And I think the main part of what copywriters need to know is around key phrases. I know we'll probably talk about that in a bit. Mm-hmm. Key phrases allow you to tell Google what you do. And it sounds really obvious, but if you look at loads of websites where the title tag on the homepage says home, and it's not a website about the word home, of course, that's not helping. You know, those kind of level issues, but across the whole website. So writers and content allow you to rank. You know, when you're thinking about writing, you should be thinking from an SEO perspective. If SEO is the thing you want to achieve, like, how will this be perceived? So is this piece of content, will it attract links? Is it so cool? Because links are still a big part of SEO, and we probably won't go too much detail on that today, but big part is getting links from other websites to yours. If that content's so great that it attracts lots of links, that adds to the authority of a website. Or do we want that content to rank in its own right? So does that fit over the overall strategy, the marketing strategy for that website? So is that content going to answer someone's question? Is it written about something people are looking for? So from an SEO perspective, someone types something to Google, as we all know, a load of answers come back or a load of results. How do we make that content fit into that world? And that is a writer's game at that point. Mm-hmm. It might be led potentially if it's optimized by an SEO strategy, but the writer has to make that content fit to that objective so that Google sees it, works out what it is, and ranks for it as well. And so you show, so you actually get the traffic. Then, of course, after that, it's about trying to convert whatever that might be for that client, if that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. So where, you know, once upon a time, it used to be, here are the key phrases, here are the search terms that you have to cram in 7.6 times per 100 words or whatever it is. How much of that sort of, you know, keywords and keyword density, how much is that still important, and how much of it is more about interpreting the intent behind somebody's search?
Such a good question. It's the key phrases are the crux of everything we do still. It's absolutely the first thing we do. We get a client, we're trying to work out, we're looking for insight, we're trying to look out what the potential customer, user, interactor is looking for, and then we create a list of phrases around that, and then we look at the industry and say, well, how well is everyone doing, and where are you, or you, Mr. Client, where do you rank on that spectrum as well? Are you anywhere for those words that people are looking for? And what are the words? What's that lexicon of words? Like, is it mug or cup, for example, just thinking about kind of innocuous kind of key phrases. But they're two different things, in potentially in a search. So you want to make sure that everyone is using the right phrase. So we're looking for the way we term something. We want everyone to do that. We want the copywriters to do that. We want the marketeers, the admin, the PR people. So yeah, with key phrases, we are looking really to create, it's the objectives. That's the thing we're measured on as SEO. So we look for rank. If rank changes and grows, traffic grows it proportionally. And in fact, the higher up the first page you go, it becomes disproportionately higher as well. As everyone knows, everyone wants to be position one. So key phrases are important. From a content writing point of view, it's easy to over-transfix on them as well. So it's got to be natural. Google, the most recent algorithm updates in Google look for intent more than just the semantics of that word. Traditionally, you put in football, you get a result from Wikipedia about football. Nowadays, if you put football in yesterday, you might get the England score or whatever as well. So that's quite different, or something about the World Cup. If you think about that, it's inferring what you're looking for based on what's going on in the world right now. That takes intelligence to do that. It's not a direct reaction. So it is bright, and Google does work things out. So what you want from a key phrase point of view is a list of the way we say things. And actually, key phrase research or key phrase insight that we do can also tell you what perhaps people are looking for. So perhaps that gives you some ideas what to write about later. You don't have to have the title, but at least it tells you loads of people are typing these words in, and these are the phrases that are being used right now. So if we write about those, we're going to jump in front of that traffic stream if the site is optimized. There's some other areas in SEO that, of course, are quite technical. But that, from a writer's point of view, a key phrase list is really vital. And then actually seeing how that appears in Google later as well, and just following up a month later and being like, do you know what, I actually rank on the first page for how to XYZ. That's great. And then you go to Google Analytics, and I've driven traffic, and I've driven conversion. Cool. That's really good. But the key phrase is the kind of the central pivot for everyone. So everyone, that's the KPI, effectively, from an SEO perspective.
It's always really interesting for us, because as writers, once something's signed off, the client kind of forgets that we're there. Sure. So we never find out how something ranked or whether it, you know, it's so rare. Like occasionally someone will come back to us and go, oh, that thing you wrote, we actually got some business off the back of that. We, you know, because particularly with us, we work in B2B. So it's big, you know, so often it's like a really big deal, you know, it's a £1 million deal or something.
Yeah.
You know, and go, oh yeah, someone came and, you know, we got £1 million worth of business off that thing you wrote. But it's so rare that anybody actually bothers to tell us what happened next.
Yeah, exactly.
After sign off. And from that point of view of closing the circle that you were talking about, that feedback obviously helps us to improve. But by the sound of it, so it's more about Google being the channel to write for people. I mean, from our point of view, Google is not your audience. Users of Google are your audience. And the keyword research tells you what they want.
Yes, exactly right. So it's just you're trying to find trend and insight around a topic or around a product, a service, or a big report, or whatever that might be, especially in B2B. If someone's writing a big report on the state of the industry, how do people frame that? And what's the semantics around that? Because let's make sure we're jumping in front of the right stream of people. So you might get a persona and you might apply key phrases to that. It might be more simple in certain cases. But yeah, you're just trying to jump ahead of the game. So you're trying to, if you think there's thousands and thousands of searches going on every millisecond, you're trying to jump in front of the relevant ones. You've got to think about, is there volume for that, most importantly? Because if no one's searching for it in the first place, then the optimization piece isn't right. You might try and create volume by writing something so amazing that it's going to create a whole genre. But you know, you're looking for volume, you're looking for achievability. Now, if you're a small website and the top 10 results or pages are taken up by loads of large corporates and you're a little plucky startup, are you actually going to get there for this hugely difficult key phrase, hugely competitive key phrase, especially in financial services, more so in consumer than B2B? B2B's got a lot of opportunity in SEO. But from a B2C point of view, is it actually achievable? Like, I want to be number one for the word credit card. It's probably not going to happen. You know, that kind of thing. There's certain words, Samsung TV. If you're a little startup...
Don't be so defeatist.
Yeah. Realist. But then also, will that actually convert? The third thing is, it's got volume. We can definitely get somewhere over a period of time that's going to be cost effective. Will it actually convert? Is it actually relevant? Or are we chasing our ego of a word that we want to rank for that actually our website doesn't do? If you're very niche, you don't want a broad key phrase, because people that are looking for something more niche are more likely to convert. They're further down that buying journey as well.
So the more niche key phrases, they're more achievable and also likely to have more of a better conversion rate as well than something. Because often we get a keyword list through from a client, you know, and it will just be like, bank, and you kind of think
that's not key phrase research at that point.
You kind of think, really?
Yeah,
You don't want, you know, digital transformation trends in banking industry.
No, if you get that and that's what people are looking for, then your report will rank, you know. But remember that what we would call a long tail key phrase, phrase at that point, more than a word like bank, that will rank, but of course a fraction of the people are looking for it. In reality, does anyone put bank in anymore? We used to get that quite a lot. Uh-huh. And in theory, bank would have the most traffic and the least conversion. And then digital transformation in banking would have the least traffic, but probably the highest conversion. Because, of course, if you're looking for that, you're definitely going to click on it, because that is niche. And as long as the page at that point, away from kind of effectively from writing in SEO, that page has a call to action on it, you're going to convert that person. Well, that might be a lead, a download, a sale, whatever that is, or just really, really strong awareness. I think that's probably the kind of the play.
Cool. So when you're working with a client and there's a copywriter involved, what sort of workflow works for you? Do you set the strategy, then they write the thing, and then you give feedback on the writing? What flow sort of? Because there are various ways to approach it. So what sort of workflow works best for you?
Usually, there's a theme in the industry already, or there's a thing the client is going to be doing or feels is important if they're leading that industry. So you've often got a sub-theme going on already, which is probably quite a broad topic. And then it is a bit chicken and egg when we work with content writers. We do a lot. So actually, should key phrases set the agenda? Well, maybe not. Maybe they should just feed into that pot. So maybe they should be running parallel. Later on, I think there's more SEO influence. But at the start, key phrase research can help with ideation. If you're trying to think of something to write about, hopefully that feeds in. Just say, over here, these type of words are actually getting quite a lot of traffic. And then let's say, how do we break the tail down on that and have lots of multiple articles around that area? So how do we gain our authority in this group of key phrases? That's kind of SEO-led, but of course, the underlying strategy tells you what you're going after. And then the guys that are doing the writing usually have a really, really deep level understanding of what they're about to write about as well. So they're probably better experts in that area. So it's definitely a hand-in-hand thing, for sure. Mm-hmm. SEO, if we can do that in inverted commas, I'll do my little inverted commas hands.
Works so well on a podcast.
Perfect for pods. We might be looking at benchmark of the entire industry. So all the main competitors, where do they rank for those phrases? In fact, maybe there's an area the client doesn't rank, but the competitors do. Or vice versa. Or maybe there's something which has got volume and no one ranks for it. Like, tick, that's great. There's an opportunity. That's what we do a gap analysis for. Mm. If we, that's influencing. And then perhaps once we've got those groups of key phrases, there are tools like Answer the Public, which is a brilliant tool for trying
so
to...
So much fun.
Love Answer the Public.
That guy, who's the guy with the beard?
I don't know.
Is he just a random...
An internet enigma. Maybe we should get him in.
I don't know. If the listener hasn't seen Answer the Public, they have no idea who the guy with the beard and the jumper is.
No.
Just go to answerthepublic.com. We'll put a link in the show notes.
No, so I mean, that might also allow you to break down further. Because you've got key phrases at different levels. There's the core thing that company does. Ben, when away from just the everyday refresh of content, if you're talking about just effectively static content for products and services, that's got to be optimized. That might be slightly more SEO-led because there's a broader picture, which I'll talk about in a second. But in terms of a content flow for producing day-to-day content for kind of knowledge bases, blogs, that starts hand-in-hand. In theory, the platform, the website, is optimized. What often happens is we have a content schedule which is based around the key phrases and are based around the client's objectives, but we might have a little feedback loop, which is when that thing's ready to go, We often do a lot of training in how to write title tags and how to write H1s and how to think about the things that you can influence yourself without needing a technical SEO person around. But what you might do is have a feedback loop with the SEO person, just as a quick look over it and goes, yeah, do you know what? That's great. Or maybe we could put the key phrases in there a bit better. Or actually, are we sure that's the right word? And it just goes back a tiny, it's not really an editorial loop, but it is a way of trying to make sure that when that goes live, that's the most optimized it can be. And then it goes. And then a feedback loop later to say, how well did that go?
That's the cool bit when you get it right.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I mean, certainly from our point of view, I think what we do a lot of the time, because we include a couple of rounds of amends in the standard pricing that we include for clients, we just suggest that, you know, if it is web copy and, you know, if they hopefully have an SEO expert around, we get them, you know, in that first round of feedback, build that feedback loop into that when they go to their stakeholders and say, okay, here's the first draft. What do we need to tweak? Make sure that the SEO person is included on that list.
Yeah.
And so the feedback loop for us, I think, happens then, usually, which means that, the piece is basically there, but if it's like, could you put that word, you know, near the front of the sentence or whatever it is,
then
we can do that at that stage.
Yeah, it's subtle and it's not a huge impact piece of work. And in theory, if the SEO person's going to be experienced in that topic, which they should be by this point because we've done a lot of work on it, it should be a quick yay or nay, actually, or could we just do that? That's okay. Or there's a broader picture which goes further back up the chain again of like, we're still not writing on this area that much.
Yeah.
And that is a client objective. So can we look at how can we write more on these words over here? That would be cool for next time. Yeah. But that's not necessarily in that first feedback loop. That's in that broader month-to-month feedback loop of actually, we've got loads of content on this subject, but over here, we don't. And there's definitely an opportunity there. So I think that's the relationship. So it's hand in hand. It's not one leading the other. Mm. I think it's here's the insight, here's the things. You're the writers, you do a much better job of that, you do that, and then we will come back through and then have a look again.
Yeah, so it's almost SEO and content strategy and copywriting.
Definitely.
Overlapping, like three circles in a Venn diagram that I'm now drawing in the air, and again, the listener cannot see.
No.
It's terrible, I talk with my hands so much and no one can see.
Yeah, same.
So, you have the ear of... Yeah. You know, a number of marketers, but also copywriters.
Yeah.
On this podcast, what do we as writers get wrong? What winds you up? What do you most want? What one thing do you most want copywriters to know and do differently?
From an SEO perspective, we'll be very careful. Right. There's a lot of content for content's sake sometimes.
Oh God, yeah.
Because you're perhaps the metric that you're benched on perhaps is you are paid to do X, Y, Z per month.
Uh-huh.
What the difficulty is sometimes, if you're locked in a bit of a rut, you'll find that content doesn't achieve. Is it going to rank in its own right? Is it going to attract links? Or potentially can a marketeer use that on another blog in exchange for something, links or awareness or traffic? So the only thing we see was perhaps a lack of objective from an SEO point of view. You've got to be really careful as the SEO person in the room thinking about what the listeners do. But from an SEO perspective, totally covering my ass, it's about that objective. And that is missing at points because it's often not part of the KPI suite that's done to influence change. It's like, I want to write more wonderful things to become a thought leader in my area. That's what the clients are after. And they want more content and they want to appear. Or they want their site to be written right. You know, those kind of things, tone of voice, etc. Sometimes SEO is not really part of that brief in the first place. And I think don't be afraid to use the title tag. It makes up a huge amount of the influence in Google. Get that right and the site is optimized underneath. So the foundations of the website, the technical foundations and the architectural foundations are right, are optimized, which is quite a niche job. Then actually, if you're writing things, it should start to appear. But actually, you know, the H1 and a title can be different. They can be in a different order. That's good. It looks nice. It reads better. But if you feel like the key phrase doesn't fit, don't do it, because it will just look rubbish immediately. And if it looks rubbish, Google's not stupid either. So these key phrases are far too dense. So the whole kind of the old adage of X, Y, Z words per ABC, that's naff. But there are a few key places if you put the key phrases in them, in those titles, it will most likely rank. And that's good. And remember to internally link other articles on the website or other products and services. Internal linking is important. And you can put anchor text on that hyperlink. and that will be associated. When Google crawls the site, it will see the thing you've written, and maybe you linking back internally to other parts of your website that are relevant to what you're talking about. That's really good, because you're spreading the kind of the Google love around your website.
So if the listener doesn't know what anchor text is...
Good point. On the link, so on a hyperlink, mm-hmm. inside that hyperlink, you can choose what the word is you click, as opposed to writing click here or right. brand name. You could put blah, 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 CR report on banking XYZ, you know, and that... And actually, that banking XYZ is the key phrase. Banking, I don't know, the future of tech in banking. See our report on the future of tech in banking. That adds key phrase value to the overall website yourself. And it's not spammy. If you get lots of links from other sites to yours with the anchor text, that word on the hyperlink, mm-hmm. that can be seen as spammy. But internally, you've got good control. And it's definitely worth doing. And you own that as well. And it's easily done.
Cool. Thank you. So if... the listener wants to know more about, you know, all of this and H1 tags and anchor text and how to do a good title tag. I mean, is there anywhere that's particularly good for them to go for advice, for further reading? I mean, we can put links in the
the Three White Hats blog.
Of course, the Three White Hats blog.
There's Moz.com is very good.
I love their title page validator tool thing.
Really good. Moz is great. Ahrefs, uh-huh. they have got a really good blog as well. And between those two, you can learn quite a lot, actually. I mean, obviously, usually you can Google something and work it out. Mm. But I think baseline, if you're new to SEO, Moz, Ahrefs, you'll pick up enough to be really effective.
Lovely. Well, thank you very much for your time. I think this is something that we'll probably need to revisit regularly, because, I mean, you know, as writers, it's something that we're asked, you know, all the time. And naturally, where you have this great big repository of information on what people are looking for and what words they are using to find that, that's got to be really, really useful to us as writers who are just trying to engage with an audience and to make something that people care about and will want to read.
Yeah.
So hopefully, you know, we're all on the same page.
On the same page.
Web page. Thanks very much for your time, Tom. And we'll include a link to Three White Hats in the show notes so people know where to find you.
Awesome. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. So, Fiona, Tom was saying there how search engine keyword data can help us by giving us ideas for content and revealing what people want to know on the web pages that we're writing. That's how it should work in theory, but do we ever get to a point where the cart gets before the horse and we get too focused on data?
Well, not in my experience, I have to say. So, I mean, I think Tom's absolutely right, in fact, that, you know, looking at what people are searching for can give you really good ideas for content. And as we know, it's pretty good practice to answer the questions that your customers are actually asking, rather than trying to imagine what questions you'd like them to ask and then answering those questions. And we know that it works because it's something we do in our own content marketing, and it's worked very well for us as well as for some of our clients. But I don't know as to whether the cart gets put before the horse and, you know, data comes before, you know, coming up with ideas for content. I haven't seen it in my experience. And I know we're going to come on to talk about this article that Shelley Lucas has written about, you know, the death of creativity in marketing and how sort of creative thinking is being edged out in favour of just looking at the data and what works in that sense. But I don't know, maybe it's the clients that we work with, but I personally don't see an awful lot of data-driven briefs or data-driven conversations with clients. I think, you know, the clients we're working with are still looking at coming up with sort of ideas, creative ideas for campaigns that don't appear to me to be based like purely on data. I don't know what you think.
Yeah, I do sometimes see, for example, keyword lists that we're supposed to include in articles that are really random. Like somebody's looked at them and gone, here are the top five keywords by volume related to this subject, by volume of visitors or searches, but
yes,
are actually not in any way related to the thing that you're writing about?
Yes. No, I do come across that occasionally, yes. And I just tend to ignore that. So until somebody challenges me on it, I think I'm probably just going to continue to ignore long lists of keywords that are only tangentially related to the actual topic. I will actively ignore, yes.
So, I mean, you mentioned the article by Shelley Lucas, and it is clearly, you know, it's a long and impassioned article. And it's a rising, I think, point of view that... that somehow data is overwhelming creativity. I mean, there was a thing more recently where Ian Leslie wrote in the New Statesman around the death of Don Draper.
Yes.
And it seems odd to me because, you know, that one in particular, because Don Draper is, you know, obviously he's inspired by lots of people as a character, but one of the original madmen that inspired him was David Ogilvy, yeah, who was viewed as being the father of the idea of brand, but he based everything he did on data. You know, everything, like all those really classic, like the classic Volkswagen, like the Volkswagen Lemon ad, the layout of that, the colouring, the font, the proportion of pictures to words, all of it is based upon optimization, iteration, testing what works.
Yeah. And I agree, and I don't think it's... I agree with Shelley that creativity is being edged out, because I do see that as well, but I don't agree that it's data that's doing it.
Oh.
So what it feels to me is, A, it's time. People are trying to do things a lot quicker. They're not allowing the time for people to come up with creative ideas, because it takes a lot of time to think of something truly different and original and creative. Mm. B, there's budget, which is linked in with time. So budgets, we know, are being really squeezed at the moment. I think Shelley makes the point in her article that a lot of brands are bringing sort of a lot of the creative work in-house and not giving very much to the agencies now. And, you know, you kind of feel now that the agencies have a lot less budget to work with than they used to, and that's having an impact on creativity, I think. And then the other thing, I think, is the proliferation of channels. So, you know, the reason why the Don Drapers of the world were as creative as they were is because they were focusing just on one or two channels. You know, there's a reason why the 1980s were the kind of golden age of TV advertising, because that was the only channel. You could put all of your thought and all of your budget and all of your best creative thinkers into that one piece, you know, for that one channel. And now you're trying to create content across hundreds of different channels, and so everything's just being fragmented.
Absolutely. I mean, I don't buy this idea. I think that somehow process is the enemy of creativity. You know, I don't view them as being, you know, antithetical. You know, and this idea, you know, I think as Shelley herself put, you know, that it's digital maths.
Yeah.
So I put an S on maths because I'm English.
We're localising here.
Yeah, we're localising the content. Yeah. We don't say math. Digital maths and emotional magic, you know, together, but it's not one or the other. And you know, similarly, like those classic ads from the 50s and 60s that are created absolutely to a formula. Mm-hmm. The optimization, if you like, sets the box, sets the boundaries for you to be creative within. This is your page.
Yeah.
Make it work within these parameters.
Yeah.
And that to me, I find that way more exciting than do anything.
Yeah, no, I absolutely agree. And I think it's something we've talked about on the podcast before. It's like, do constraints make you more creative or less creative? And I'm definitely the kind of person that likes to have those constraints in place. Mm-hmm. Almost likes to have a box to think within, if you like.
Yeah, absolutely.
But I think Shelley's article's brilliant, and I think she's put some superb thinking into it, and I don't want to go into a point by point rebuttal, but you know, there are certain things. I think at one point she mentions, you know, technology, like new technologies. I think she quotes Joe Polizzi saying, you know, VR and AR, you know, they're technologies, they can't help you with storytelling. And at another point she mentions Velocity Partners, and that just made me think, okay, so there was a new platform, and it was called SlideShare, and it appeared, and people just use it for putting PowerPoint presentations on, until Doug Kessler at Velocity Partners thought this new technology is a viable new platform for storytelling, and I'm going to show how you do storytelling on this platform. And he came up with his crap slideshare, which is the most famous B2B marketing slideshare
of all
time.
In inverted commas, you're not just describing it.
We worked on some slideshares in the wake of that, and it really was. It was like, this is a brand new technology, a brand new platform that actually forces you to tell a story in a completely different way. And I think it did give rise to an awful lot of creativity and creative thinking at the time. So I don't agree that, you know, a new technology is a barrier to storytelling at all. I think it could be the complete opposite.
Yeah, I think what Doug has done, to misquote a drowned in sound thing about how bands use social media. But the thing that I think is really interesting is when marketers, brands, copywriters, whatever, view sort of the platforms and channels and technologies available kind of the way that skaters view architecture.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah, that's a really good way of thinking about it.
Well, Someone's designed it for that, but we could use it for this.
Yes.
And then things get to be really fun, and you can take those structures and be creative with them, and it's a kind of simile that's always sort of stuck with me, really, that comparison.
Yes, yeah, and I think that's something that we definitely saw with slideshare, and I'm sure it may already be happening with VR and AR, and I might just not have seen it, but I'm sure we will see really superb kind of stories and content pieces emerge that use VR and AR. I can't see why it wouldn't happen.
I think where there maybe is an issue, and it comes back to some of what we're talking about, where people, we get lists of really weird keywords and no one's really put any thought into it, is where people think that maybe creativity is unnecessary because optimization is enough. You know, the fact that if we can just take a list of what works, mm-hmm. just do that, that maybe, you know, that what we do as quote-unquote creatives gets minimized because people think it's just optimization.
Yeah.
Rather than being, you know, taking what works and interpreting it. And I think maybe that's where, you know, if people think that optimization on its own is sufficient, then that's a problem. And that's when we all get eaten by robots, right?
Yes, but you have to have something to optimize in the first
Absolutely.
Place, which is where the creative work comes in.
True that. Well, unbelievably, we're almost out of time already.
That was so quick. I think we could talk about this forever.
Well,
this is such a good topic.
We may revisit it in the future. And tell you what, Shelley, if you're listening and you want the right of reply, we'd love to talk to you on a future podcast.
Absolutely.
About creativity and data. But Fiona, before we go, I can't let you get away without telling me about your nomination for the B2B Content Hall of Fame, because it's a slightly unusual one. Salesforce brackets, yes, all of it.
Yes, that's right. Yes, and I feel I'm being slightly counterintuitive here, especially in light of Shelley's article, because, you know, she is she's complaining about content being churned out at an industrial scale. And this actually is the thing that I really like about Salesforce. So a bit of a sort of disclosure, first of all, I have, and we at Radix have done some work for Salesforce, but this is not me blowing our own trumpets at all. I think this is a very big global brand that's getting content right, not just like individual pieces of content, but content, all of the content that it creates at the massive scale that it creates it. And I was looking, you know, they do three blog posts a day on their main blog. You know, they're creating content all the time. They've got people all around the world creating content. And yet the dynamics of content creation at Salesforce seem to be such that content is always very good. And so some of the things that they do well that other brands of the same size don't do so well is that they really kind of humanize and make really kind of lively content with a real personality to it. So, you know, it's always about people. You know, they celebrate the people that use their products. They always give really specific examples of how this product can be used or who's using it. You know, they bring everything to life. I mean, they've even come up with these like little cuddly cartoon characters to illustrate concepts like the cloud. I mean, they don't use a cloud, they use a goat. and it just, you know, and some of the metaphors that they use as well. So, you know, they have this concept of a HANA, which is the Salesforce family. And, you know, they use the metaphor of the campfire and the campgrounds at their events. And, you know, the people that use their products are trailblazers, and they have this whole kind of metaphor of going on a journey, but it's actually a trail through an American national park, and somehow they make that work globally, even though that's a very American-specific metaphor. To me, it always just makes me feel like this is a brand that loves you. and that's really... and actually sincerely loves you. And that's really odd to find with a very big global tech brand. And we've worked for a lot of those. Mm-hmm. And I think it's something that's very odd to find. And it's a really nice thing. And you know, as a writer, it affects me because when I'm doing any writing work for them, I just feel like I want to create something lovely because all of their content has this like really lovely feel to it. And so I feel inspired and motivated as a writer when I'm writing for them. Which, you know, I don't have to force myself to say I'm going to give this my best shot. I mean, I try to give everything my best shot, but I don't have to force myself. I was like, oh, yeah, Salesforce. I really enjoy writing this. So that, among many other reasons, is why I'd like to nominate Salesforce for the B2B Content Hall of Fame.
Absolutely. And although it's slightly unusual that it's a client that we've actually worked on, absolutely, I can certainly agree that we should induct them. All of Salesforce's content worldwide.
The whole lot.
And forever into the B2B Content Hall of Fame. Long live brands that actually inspire writers to give their best.
Absolutely.
Well, that really is all we have time for this month. In the next episode of Good Copy, Bad Copy, we'll be talking about how to give feedback and how to receive it without throwing your laptop out of the window. We'd love to hear about your experiences, tips, advice, where to get a replacement laptop. So email us at podcast@radix-communications.com. If you want to get us really excited, you could even email us a voice memo. It'll make Nick Prescott squeal like a chipmunk. You can also find us on Twitter at radix.com, and you'll find our website at radix-communications.com, which is a good place to sign up for our market-leading monthly email copywriting tips and advice solution. Until next time, may the thesaurus be with you. Bye-bye.